In the first half of the 20th century, Detroit's African-American population was booming. And so were the places Black Detroiters met and hung out.
Yeah, Paradise Valley was one of the key places for entertainment and culture. There was a lot of ways that entertainment and recreation was a big part of what made that area be considered thriving.
P.G. Watkins is the founder and director of the Black Bottom Archives. Along with Paradise Valley, the Black Bottom neighborhood was at the center of Black life in Detroit. The archive's mission is to preserve memories of those spaces for future generations, because those neighborhoods aren't around anymore. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. By the 1950s and 60s, those communities had been razed to make way for new highways, I-75 and 375. And for PG, the legacy of that loss is still very much alive in the city.
What's happening now in Black Detroit and what's happened then are very related, right? A lot of the policy violence of urban renewal, and the policy violence we're seeing today with the ways that folks are displaced, corporate development, private property is prioritized over people's homes, right? People's families.
Detroit is in a period of such rapid change. The boom years interrupted by COVID brought investment and new faces. Today on the podcast, we want to talk about those iconic communities of Black Bottom and Paradise Valley and see what it means now to create spaces that welcome and include Black Detroiters. P.G. Watkins is going to help us do that. P.G., good to have you.
Hey, what up, though? I'm excited to be here.
Also with us today is Lauren Hood. She's an urban planner and a leading thinker in Afro-urbanist design. Lauren, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
PG, as we get started, could you tell us a little bit more about the type of space that Paradise Valley and Black Bottom occupied for Black Detroiters and why you wanted to start the archive?
Yes. So it is more common knowledge today than it was several years ago about what Black Bottom and Paradise Valley were, particularly in the period between the 40s and the 60s, where really my work focuses on when the neighborhood started to be demolished. But the area during that time in the early 1900s was a majority Black working class neighborhood and commercial district. It's where you had a lot of the cultural center for Black Detroit. So a lot of the jazz clubs and performance halls, local businesses, doctors, pharmacies, stores, right? All of that was in Black Bottom and Paradise Valley. They had schools and churches that were also in that area, and a lot of there was a lot of residential area. And essentially the part of the story that gets talked about most often is the fact that the neighborhood Black Bottom was run through with I-375, which is the freeway that we know goes through downtown Detroit now. And this process was in the period of urban renewal, right? This federal government program that was trying to, in the same ways that we might see right now, revitalize the city, remove blight, right? Make it more appealing to visitors, to business people, to the corporate class. So really what got us wanting to start the archives about 6 years ago was this idea that the stories that were being told about Detroit weren't being told in their full truth and their full complexity. And so, yeah, we wanted to be some of the voice and some of the narrative around what's true for Black Detroiters and all of its nuance.
Let's skip forward in time a little bit now. Lauren, your focus is on creating and maintaining Black spaces in the city today through the lens of Afro-urbanism. Can you give us a quick definition of what that means in terms of thinking about the city's future?
Well, it's really, really pretty simple. It just means centering the lived experience, the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of Black people in the planning and development in Black neighborhoods. And it seems really elementary, but we don't do it that way presently.
What do you think about as the starting point for creating spaces that affirm and are welcoming to the people who actually, Black people living in the city?
Well, I think first, it's really interesting that we have to be intentional about having Black spaces in a Black city. why aren't all the spaces just our spaces? and you know, that people that are new here can be thinking about how to create spaces, you know, that reflect what they want to see. So for starters, I think we have to kind of shift the narrative about who the protagonist is in the Detroit story. Like, I think we have it wrong. The protagonist is the Black folks. It's an 80% Black city. And we kind of talk about it when we say words like inclusion, we're talking about including Black people. And I think we have, you know,
that's the focus. Backwards.
Yeah, it's backwards. The focus just needs to be back on the majority population for starters. Mm-hmm. And when you look at, oddly enough, all of the quote unquote public spaces in our downtown area, they're all these public private kind of relationships that are managed by mostly white led institutions. So when you look at like the Downtown Detroit Partnership and all, it oversees all of the public space downtown. So even when you look at what is thought to be like a public park, it's for everybody. You know, the programming is done by a private group who isn't reflective of the majority population of the city.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that design itself sometimes reinforces divisions in subtle ways?
Well, I'm a process person, so I always want to know how we arrived at something. So when I see a program at a public space, I'm like, how did you decide that was the thing to do? You know, what kind of conversations were had? Where were the conversations had? Who was invited? Who was doing the inviting? I mean, it all comes down to the kind of process. And if you're co-creating something, you're giving citizens like real agency in a process, you have outcomes that reflect that. So when I see programming that isn't reflective of us, I can kind of, you know, I know who was at the table and I know how the conversation went.
We've got to take a quick break here. In just a minute, we'll talk about the ways in which Detroit's public spaces today can reflect the lived experiences of a majority Black city. We'll be right back.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Lots of Detroiters have observed that for all the newer developments downtown, glitzy hotels, cool shops, and restaurants, a lot of it feels unaffordable or just plain unfriendly to the city's Black majority. We were just talking about how sometimes design can reinforce social divisions in subtle ways.
Lauren and I both went through the same community development master's program, and one of the things that it always has stuck with me since one of my physical development classes there was the idea of like the intentionality of what gets put in a space, like thinking about even like, where is there a table for someone to sit at and where is there not, right? And these ways, these really subtle ways that physical design does encourage us or not to stay in a place or tell us that we're welcome to stay in a place. And this is coming from a perspective of like an oppressed or marginalized person who is just used to not have, like, not just making space, right? Like, you could maybe talk to a white person who sees just the open area and is like, oh yeah, of course I could set up here. And I mean, Black folks feel that way too. And also there are ways that design welcomes people to be like, yeah, come here, sit down, have a meal, invite your folks here. Like, this is a gathering place versus like, you're only here if you're invited or if we've set it up in a very particular way for your particular group to be here, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And another thing, you know what gives me the jeebies about the downtown parks? A friend and I once counted the number of cameras pointed at the open spaces. So when you are talking about being policed in public spaces, like a camera pointed at what is supposed to be a recreational space signals to Black folks in particular, you know, that we got to watch our step.
Literally,
and I mean, someone's watching.
But right. what you're saying makes me think about even when in the first moment of COVID, right, where we're just like, what is this thing that's happening? What is this pandemic? What does it mean for how we gather or can't gather? We saw the city take down basketball rims, right? We mm-hmm. saw the city police and ticket and arrest, in some cases, groups of people who are gathering outside of stores or in parks. Black people, young Black people, right? And then to see in some, we were driving and it was like, okay, there was clearly in our areas of the city, like there were no basketball rims on any of the public parks. But then you would see in some places like, oh, there's still rims there. You know, like they didn't take down everything at this place, you know? And so just thinking about those subtle ways that, yeah, we're always being surveilled and what that does to our ability to truly enjoy ourselves. And also how deliberately they're like, don't even try to, and I mean, okay, in the name of the pandemic, it wasn't safe to do that type of stuff anyway. And also, right, like the ways that infrastructure is used to keep us out of places really explicitly and also really subtly.
PG, can you, as you do look around the city, I want to be mindful of your point, or maybe it was Lauren said it first, that a lot of the spaces that we do have in the city right now were not designed with Black Detroiters in mind. But given what we have, are there places of opportunity that you see, or places that have developed somewhat organically a more welcoming environment?
Yeah, I feel like there are some ways that we are needing to think about the reasons that in this very Black city that has been a very Black city, like why it has been such a Black city, why our spaces have been this way. Also, what was the cost, like the supreme disinvestment that has happened in this city over several decades, right? Like we were able to kind of pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, right? Like there was, I think Detroit had one of the cities that had like the highest percentage of Black home ownership at one time. And just thinking about all the ways that Black folks were thriving here, right? But that was because we had to. Like that was because the state, the federal government decided we weren't worth investing in. And not even just Black folks, but Black and brown folks, right? Indigenous people, the folks who have been here, who have stayed here, despite being told that our youth were not worth schools, right? Like so many schools closed all across neighborhoods in the city because folks decided it wasn't worthwhile to keep them open or to continue investing in them. And I think there's an opportunity for a true acknowledgement of that and to, in some ways, right the course.
Lauren Hood, how would you answer this question about our spaces of opportunity?
I feel like, you know, in recent years, we've been like, oh, we need to get more Black folks, more Native Detroiters at the table. But what I have seen is that when we are at the table, because of what we may be dealing with outside of these conversations, it's not even a fair conversation, if that makes sense. And I think, it starts with acknowledging the history, acknowledging these survival modes that people have to live in. We're calling people to the table to talk about, hey, what are your best ideas for the future of your neighborhood? But, you know, people are trying to figure out how to stay in their houses, how to get their water back on. People are underemployed. There are all these things that people have to contend with, and we're asking them to come to the table as if they're whole and ready for the conversation about their community's future. So I feel like we have to be better prepared to have different kinds of conversations with people. I think that last year's paradigm shift after George Floyd kind of encouraged more empathy. I would like to see that amongst my fellow planners and development practitioners. I feel like a lot of folks, if you aren't a person of color or from a community that has seen challenges, you kind of approach community development in an academic way. And when you're from one of these communities, you approach it more as like an agent of change kind of way. Like we have a sense of responsibility about stewarding our communities in the right way into the future. And I think that people that don't come from our communities keep it at arm's length, and it's a very academic practice. And you know, you can distance yourself from any emotion and empathy. And I think that is at the core of how it's so easy to put a freeway through a community that had doctors, lawyers. You know, we always talk about when we hear about Black Bottom about the nightclubs and the restaurants and the bars, but there were also like doctors, lawyers, beauty salons, barber shops, confectionaries. There were all manner of businesses that Black folks owned in that community. And we don't take into consideration you know, everything that gets lost. If you can think about the intergenerational wealth that was lost when those businesses got shut down, like what might those families have been able to hand down to their kids had they been able to keep those businesses? We don't think about the political will that was lost when you take away community ties. It was a tightly knit community. So yes, because of segregation, the doctor had to live next to the janitor. And there's a benefit to that. There was a strong political will in those communities. And how does that get broken down when you, you know, you put the freeway through? So there are all these things that happen that are lost that we don't think about. And I think we need to start with history. We need to rely on empathy, understand what people are going through when we're asking them to come to a table. The tables are happening across the city all the time. And I think we as planners need to go find where those conversations are happening and go be there versus trying to get people to come to where we're at and have the kind of conversation that we as planners are having. I think folks in community are already having the right kind of conversations. We just need to plug into those.
Lauren Hood is an urban planner and consultant based in Detroit. We've also been talking today with P.G. Watkins, an organizer, also the founder and director of the Black Bottom Archives. P.G., Lauren, thank you so much for being with us. It's good to hear your voices.
You too.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thanks for giving me an excuse to talk to PG. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, ditto.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. We would love it if you could subscribe wherever you're listening to us right now. If you've got a minute, please rate the podcast and leave us a review. We always appreciate the feedback, and it helps other people find the show, too. Stateside's executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by April Van Buren. Our theme music is by 14KT. With additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.